This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present Miss Julia Raises the Roof by Anne B. Ross. Narrated by Cynthia Darlow. Chapter 1. I'm getting old and I don't much like it. On the other hand, as Lillian has reminded me, it could be worse. I pulled my sweater closer and smiled to myself as I thought of a bright spot. I certainly wasn't the only one suffering from sagging muscles and deep wrinkles and aching joints and poor eyesight and you name it. Everybody else I knew was getting old, too. Of course, some started later than others, so they're not yet getting that shock when they look in a mirror first thing in the morning. They think they'll look that way forever. They'll change their tune, though, if they last long enough. Now, why, you may ask, was I burdened with such dark, unedifying thoughts? Because, I answer, it behooves us all to stop and take stock on occasion, and that's what I was doing on a warm October day as I sat in a wicker rocking chair on my wisteria-covered front porch. People used to sit on their porches after supper on pretty days, rocking and cooling off and speaking to neighbors as they walked by. But nobody walks anymore. They're either zipping past in air-conditioned cars or bent over the handlebars of bicycles, their spandex-covered backsides hiked above their heads, or gasping for air as they pound by on their LeBron James Nike running shoes. Oh, and by the way, I happened to know that there wasn't a one of those runners who'd ever played a game of basketball in their lives. Since no one was taking notice, too caught up in their own worlds, I was content to sit partially hidden by the vine that covered a third of my porch. Wisteria. Even the slow-growing kind offers protection from prying eyes only a few months of the year, and those months were about over, leaving mostly bare, twisting stems that ran up to the roof and blocked the gutters. I'd have to do something about that. But not today. Today was given over to taking stock and feeling sorry for myself. I'd get over it, but I've found that when you're in such a mood, it's better to go ahead and wallow in it, thereby getting it out of your system, than to let it simmer on for days. Weeks, in fact, for some people. And for others, well, they seem to never get over it. Don't you just hate it when an old person gets crabbier and crabbier and harder to live with? They say that however you are when you're young, you get worse as you age. And I believe it. I've seen it happen time and again, but not in my household, thank the Lord. Sam is as even-tempered and easygoing as he ever was, and for that I will be eternally grateful. Every once in a while, especially when I'm in one of these moods, I wonder what Wesley Lloyd Springer, my late unlamented first husband, would have been like if the Lord hadn't taken pity on me and taken him to his reward years ago. Of course, even if he hadn't, I wouldn't have been around to witness Wesley Lloyd's descent into ill-tempered dotage. I would have been long gone as soon as I learned what he'd been up to. There'd never been a divorce in my family. But there's always a first time, and mine would have been it. I rocked a little harder as I thought of all I would have missed if Wesley Lloyd had continued to live on, getting grouchier by the day. Lloyd, for one, his ill-begotten son, who is the sunshine of my life, and Sam, for another, who is more than I ever dreamed of or deserved in a husband. And I would have sorely missed Hazel Marie as well, even though some of my friends still wonder how I can bring myself to love her as I do. So she'd been my husband's kept woman. Think of what despair she must have been in to have stooped that low.
Miss Julia?
I looked up to see Lillian at the screen door. Oh, sorry, Lillian, I must have been daydreaming.
You better come on in. It's getting a little chilly out here, and supper'll be ready in a few minutes.
Yes, all right. Thank you, Lillian. I'm coming. With an extra push of my foot, I was able to spring from the rocker to my feet and follow her inside. "Lillian," I said as we reached the kitchen, "I've got to stop letting my mind wander all over the place. I seem to be doing a lot of that here lately, and it's not healthy."
"What you need is something to do till Mr. Sam get back, so why don't you get busy and find it?"
"You're exactly right. I do need something to do. But Lord, Lillian, I've lived so long that I think I've already done everything I possibly can."
"I don't want to hear no more grumbling about how you getting old. Just be glad you're still getting there."
Lillian poured a pot of beans into a bowl, steam rising about her head.
"Think about that church across the street. From what I hear, it need all the help it can get."
That set me back on my heels. If Lillian had heard gossip about the First Presbyterian Church of Abbotsville, then how many others had heard the same? It was not like me to let things get so far out of hand that internal church business became the topic of conversation around town. "It's certainly something to think about," I said, realizing all of a sudden that when you got right down to it, my problem wasn't age, it was boredom. And right then and there, I determined that it was past time that I put my hand to the plow. Chapter 2. Before he'd left on that hazardous trip of his, Sam had made me promise to stay out of trouble.
"Don't do anything foolish," was the way he'd put it,
so it had been easy to give my word. I never did anything foolish. Ill-advised, perhaps, but never anything out-and-out foolish. Actually, a big part of my current discontent, which Lillian had heard me moan about time and time again, was the fact that Sam was off on that highly unnecessary trip, traipsing around Europe at the same time that gangs of terrorists were doing the same thing. I was sick with worry, but nothing would do but that he had to go. He was determined to see the great cathedrals, the French Gothic ones being high on his list, just the sort of landmarks that would also draw the interest of madmen bent on wanton destruction. And Sam was in and out of every one of them.
"Julia," he'd said when he had first broached the subject, "honey, I am just fed up with the way the world is going. All our great accomplishments, which we love to boast about, boil down to little more than nuclear arsenals, satellites, cars, and more intricate and expensive devices. iPads, iPods, and iPhones that can be used to send pictures of naked people or to prey on children? What a legacy to leave. But that's what our society has seen fit to build, and every last one of them is made to wear out or be used up or upgraded and replaced. And to top it off, every Tom, Dick, and Harry can tweet, Twitter, or email half-baked opinions about everything under the sun and be listened to."
Surprised by his strong feelings, I had sat quietly listening as he got it all off his chest, and he'd had plenty to get off.
"And Julia," he'd gone on, "that's the sort of thing our generation and the ones coming after us are spending their lives doing. Coming up with more and better ways to intrude on others or get their names and faces on television. And half of them are high on legalized marijuana. I'm sick of it. I want to go see those grand, magnificent cathedrals that men spent their lives building, and not just their lives, but the lives of the following generations. Why, honey, some of those cathedrals took more than 100 years to complete, and thousands of everyday men trudged to work every day to spend their entire lives working on something that they knew they'd never see finished. They did it not for their own glory or to put more money into corporate pockets, but for the glory of God. And after centuries of wars, daily use, and weather of all kinds, those great monuments are still standing, still being used, and still awe-inspiring." "Think of the contrast," he'd said, waving his arms. Those Apple people and others like them come up every year or two with a new phone just so the last one, also introduced with great fanfare, will be obsolete. I want to go see something that was built to last and see it before some hate-driven maniac attacks it. I could understand that. My concern was that he'd be there when that hate-driven maniac decided to do it. But off he went, and here I stayed. Well, that wasn't unusual. He'd taken long trips before while I'd stayed at home. We were doing exactly what each of us wanted to do, which is exactly what makes a good marriage.
Lord here, Miss Julia.
Lillian had glanced through the window and seen Lloyd crossing the yard to the back door.
Supper on the table in about 2 minutes.
Lloyd, now a sophomore in high school, was staying with me while Sam was gone. He spent most of the day in classrooms, and the rest of it in extracurricular activities, getting home around dinner time to eat and do his homework. But just to have him in the house, even though we both were sleeping during most of his free time, was a comfort and a joy.
"Hey, Miss Julia,"
Lloyd said, unslinging his bulging backpack and dropping it to the floor.
"Hey, Miss Lillian, I'm starving. Supper about ready?"
"More than about," Lillian said. "I'm putting it on the table right now."
"Lloyd," I said as we sat at the table and began to fill our plates, "do you think our society produces anything that will outlast us?"
"Huh?"
The laden fork that was halfway to his mouth stopped short.
"I mean, ma'am?"
"I'm talking about the big picture. What have we built or produced that will last for centuries? Like a cathedral, for instance. Is there anything we've done like that?" "Oh, sure. Think of all the discoveries in medicine, in cyberspace, in transportation, and electricity, and so on. I mean, you can't go see them like you can a cathedral, but you sure can get the use out of them."
Then I guess that wouldn't have dissuaded Sam, even if I'd thought of it.
"Anyway," I went on, "how was school?"
"Pretty good. The Key Club met this afternoon, and we're trying to come up with a good fundraiser. Probably end up doing a candy sale like last year and the year before."
"Oh, by the way," Lloyd said, as if it were a matter of little import, "I'll be going to school early a couple mornings a week. Miss Turner asked me to help a freshman with algebra."
I looked up.
"You mean like tutoring?"
"Yes'm, I guess," he said, shrugging. "Just go over his homework with him and make sure he understands it."
I glowed with pride at my smart boy, but refrained from expressing it.
"I'll make breakfast for you on those mornings."
"No, that's okay. All I want is cereal and peanut butter toast."
Lillian rolled her eyes, then said,
"He grown up all right."
When Lillian left after supper to pick up Letitia, her great-granddaughter, from after-school care, I adjourned to the library while Lloyd went upstairs to do his homework. I kept his room exactly as he wanted it, even though he also had a room at his mother's house. Essentially, the boy had two homes, one with Hazel Marie and her husband, J.D. Pickens, P.I., and the other with Sam and me. At one time, I had wondered if such an arrangement would induce some sort of schizophrenic reaction in the boy, but Lloyd was as normal as you could want, in spite of how and by whom he'd been conceived, and completely unspoiled, in spite of his half of the huge inheritance left to him by Wesley Lloyd Springer, his father and my first husband. After locking the doors for the evening, I sat on my Chippendale sofa in the library, flipping through a magazine and finding nothing that was remotely readable. Sighing, I wondered what Sam was doing. Then, recalling the time difference, I thought that he was probably asleep, resting from a strenuous day and preparing for another just like it. I'd told him to be sure and take some Advil or a similar medication for the sore neck he would most certainly get from craning it all day long with those soaring ceilings. When the phone rang, I quickly answered it, hoping for something, anything, that would lift me out of the doldrums from which I couldn't seem to free myself. be careful what you hope for. You just might get it.
Miss Julia,
Hazel Marie said,
I just learned something that's upset me so bad I can hardly stand it.
What? What's going on, Hazel Marie?
Well, you know the Cochran house, the one right beside us?
When Hazel Marie and Mr. Pickens married, they had bought Sam's lovely old house. He no longer needed it, having found his permanent home with me. Located 4 blocks from us, Sam's house sat on a large lot that ran from Jackson Street on the front to McKinley Street on the back, taking up a third of the block. The smaller, much less grand Cochran house and one other, the even smaller Osborne house, both craftsman bungalows in style, were situated on the remaining two-thirds that faced Jackson Street. 2 other houses facing McKinley Street backed up to them, one owned by an elderly couple, the Pickrells, and the other by the Winsteads, who'd raised 3 well-mannered and accomplished children there. All of the houses on that block, as well as those on the surrounding blocks, had been built long before any town planner thought to protect the area. Zoning had come late, well after the town had grown up around the cluster of historic houses. Sam's house, substantial but graceful in contrast to the Cochran's, had been well built and well maintained, so that was one thing I could point him to as having stood the test of time.
Well, yes, of course I know the Cochran house, I responded to her question. It's been empty for a good while, hasn't it?
Yes, and that's the problem, Hazel Marie said, her voice sounding strained.
Somebody's bought it.
Well, I hope they fix it up. Do you know who it is?
I just found out, even though it's obvious they didn't want it known.
Miss Julia? It was cut and dried from the beginning, and they took every pain to make sure that nobody would know until it was too late to do anything.
I'm so upset, she went on. And wouldn't you know it, J.D.'s off on another case.
Mr. Pickens was a private investigator on retainer to a large insurance company, so he was frequently called away to look into suspected wrongdoings, like fraud, embezzlement, and other unsavory and illegal activities.
Who bought it, Hazel Marie? I can't imagine it would be worse than just letting it sit there unattended.
Oh, it could be worse, all right. A group. A non-profit, of course, that sits around making grandiose plans for others to carry out and pay for. They've bought it.
That was a surprise, as was Hazel Marie's use of the word grandiose. But now that her twin girls had grown out of the baby stage, she'd embarked on a self-education course, looking up a new word every day and using it at least once. Apparently, she'd successfully completed this day's task.
What kind of group is it? I mean, why do they want a house?
For a group home, she said, as if she were gritting her teeth. A residential group home, Miss Julia, and they're putting it in a residential, single-family neighborhood, and they're going to fill it with homeless boys, along with house parents, counselors, and who knows what else. I'm just sick about it, and I know that as a Christian I shouldn't feel that way, but these will be boys in detention, or on parole, or already in a state of degeneracy.
I don't know exactly what.
Mr. Pickrell, you know, he lives right behind the Cochran house facing McKinley Street. He said he'd heard they're what's called at-risk boys. So what does that mean? What if it means there'll be boys who are on the verge of trouble? The only thing I know is they'll be right next door to my little girls, and I don't like it.
She stopped as if she were out of breath.
And next door to Lloyd, too, and he's just at the age to be influenced.
Well, Hazel Marie, I said, firming up my voice to encourage her, even as I thought that she'd used up a whole week's worth of new words,
we'll just have to do something about that.
But what? They've already applied for permission from the zoning board, and they're acting like they've gotten it, or at least expect to get it.
Hazel Marie suppressed a sob.
They went behind our backs with that, too.
What's this group's name?
Homeless Teens or Teen Home Incorporated, something like that.
Well, my goodness, I said. I've already contributed to 2 nonprofit groups this year that are looking after the homeless. Wonder what they did with it if another group had to be formed. Who's on the board?
I don't know, Hazel Marie said, sounding hopeless, except that I know the chairman or the president or whatever it is.
Who is it?
Madge Taylor.
Madge Taylor! I was so taken aback that I all but shouted the name. Well, I said with a huff of indignation, we'll just have to see about that.
Chapter 3
That woman! I might have known she'd be involved in some way. Madge Taylor had come to town some 10 or so years before, a widow with a young son called Sonny, who now, with long hair, wispy beard, poor posture, and no ambition, was the culmination of every mother's dread. Madge, to her credit, was devoted to him. Smilingly brushing aside any concerns as he slouched his way through some kind of existential phase, whatever that was. But Madge didn't let Sonny slow her down, for she was the ultimate do-gooder, always trying to get other people to follow through on the ideas she'd dreamed up. Now, I don't mind doing a little good here and there, and I occasionally spread it around quite thickly. But I do it when I'm of a mind to do it, not when somebody else expects me to facilitate some wild and woolly idea she's had. Instead of ranting about the Taylor woman, though, I calmed myself down enough to tell Hazel Marie that it wasn't over until it was over, and it seemed to me that it had just started. "What does Mr. Pickens say about it?" I asked.
"He doesn't know yet. But I just know he's not going to like having juvenile delinquents next door."
Yes, I thought to myself, and he's not going to like his property values going down either. But I didn't say that to her. She was concerned enough already. "Well, look, Hazel Marie," I said, "do you know how far along they are? I know you said something about checking on the zoning, but are they still looking at the house, or have they actually bought it?"
"Jan Osborne told me she heard that somebody's just closed on it. She lives on the other side of the Cochran house at the end of the block, and Miss Julia, she is just beside herself about this. You know she's a single mother, divorced, I think, with a 13-year-old daughter who's as pretty as a picture, and she's developing early, too. Can you imagine a house full of boys living next door to her?"
"Oh, my, that would certainly be cause for concern for her mother." "But Hazel Marie, if they've already closed on the Cochran house, that means they had enough money for the down payment, and I wonder where they got it. Nobody's approached me to contribute anything."
"Well," Hazel Marie said, sniffling a little, "they did me. Madge caught me right after church a few Sundays ago when both babies were crying, and she said she knew I'd want to contribute because Lloyd had been homeless at one time, and she knew that I wouldn't want another child going through that."
Hazel Marie swallowed hard.
"I gave her $500, and J.D.'s going to kill me."
"Oh, my goodness. Well, just don't tell him."
"If I'd known they were going to use my donation to ruin my own neighborhood, I wouldn't have done it."
"Of course not. Don't worry about it, Hazel Marie. But it just goes to show the kind of gall that woman has." And it also went to show how piercingly accurate Madge Taylor could be in laying on the guilt. Hazel Marie was the perfect victim for her insinuations. "Now listen, Hazel Marie. Let me ask around and see what I can find out. What did you say the name of the group is?"
"I'll have to look in my checkbook to see who I made a check out to. Hold on a minute."
After more than a minute, she picked up the phone and said,
"Homes for Teens, Inc." Though Madge wanted me to put Homes, the number 4, Teens, but I'd already written it the other way.
"That sounds like her being as cute as possible." "Well, Hazel Marie," I said, feeling that I'd just found the plow to put my hand to, "one more question. Will they be taking in little boys, toddlers and so on, or school-age children?" No'm, it'll only be boys aged 14 to 18, about the age of her boy, which is strange because you'd think she'd already have her hands full with him, bless his heart. But, Miss Julia, you know they'll be playing that loud music at all hours and slamming doors and yelling and screeching off in their cars. And you know J.D., there's no telling what he'll do with all that going on.
Let me see if I can find out anything more, Hazel Marie. I'm sure we can do something about this. I'll talk to Binky first and see if anything can be done legally. Just don't worry about it tonight. And after a few more comforting words to her, I hung up, knowing that in spite of my urging Hazel Marie not to worry, that that was exactly what both of us would do. 14 to 18-year-olds. My word, that's when their hormones were at peak activity. And they were already in trouble? That was not a good combination, because from the little I knew about the maturation process of male children, hormonal urges and delinquency often went hand in hand. Lloyd, I thought, what effect would a house full of boys only a year or so older have on him? As far as I could tell, Lloyd had not yet felt the pangs of puberty. There was, however, now that I thought of it, the occasional croak in his voice and a shadowy hint above his lip. So maybe he was already in the throes and I'd not paid attention. I desperately wanted to talk to Binky, my curly-haired lawyer, but I refrained from calling her at home. She had limited time to spend with little Gracie and Coleman, and for all I knew, they might be in the midst of bedtime stories. But first thing in the morning, I would make arrangements to get her advice as to how we could go about preventing a precipitous move by unwanted neighbors. Madge Taylor, I thought, and sat back down on the sofa. The woman had to be suffering from a case of boredom like I'd never experienced. I knew that the cure for boredom was getting up and doing something. The more active it was, the better. And Madge must have known it, too. She was always coming up with some new plan that on the surface seemed beneficial to somebody, but which, on further examination, proved to be a repetition of something already in the works or completely untenable to put into effect. She didn't take it well when a plan of hers was tabled or outright rejected. She put it around that a failure by the town or by a church to adopt an idea of hers and put it into practice was a rejection of poor, suffering humanity of which Abbotsville had its fair share. But Madge couldn't seem to understand that the many charities and non-profit organizations already in the town were in need of help. They would have welcomed her with open arms, but no, she had to have one of her own. You would think that sooner or later she would learn. But so far she hadn't. I happened to know that when she first came to town, she'd joined the First Methodist Church and left when they turned down her idea of making soup every Wednesday, opening the fellowship hall and feeding the hungry, actually anybody who walked in. The church had gone as far as putting a notice in the bulletin asking for volunteers for soup making. Then shelved the idea when only one woman out of 1,000 or so members on the roll signed up for one Wednesday a month. And she'd had her right arm in a cast. Madge had then moved her letter to a small but very active Baptist church. Their members were always volunteering to walk for hunger or run for something or other, or collect used clothing for the unclothed, or bring in a traveling evangelist, or sign up for almost any do-gooder activity in the town. Madge seemed to feel at home there, volunteering with the best of them. But it wasn't long before she was church shopping again. There'd been several rumors about what had happened at the little Baptist church. All Madge would say was that they had no vision, which, interpreted by me, meant that they wouldn't jump on some bandwagon that she'd rolled out. Later, I'd heard that she'd left because she'd asked the pastor to let her preach, and he wouldn't do it. Not because she was a woman, as she'd claimed, but because she wasn't a preacher. So now, here she was in our Presbyterian church, and she'd gotten to us just as we were welcoming our new pastor.
Pastelary Ledbetter had retired at the beginning of summer, and perhaps, unfortunately, he and his wife, Emma Sue, chose to remain in Abbotsville. Most retiring pastors moved away as soon as they could, so that parishioners would look to the new preacher for pastoral care. But Pastor Ledbetter lingered on, seemingly unable to turn over the church to a callow and untried replacement. And that new pastor was one Robert Rucker, called from a small church in the eastern part of the state, but who was a native of some Midwestern state. And those in the know will understand, because of where he'd grown up, that he would be less than familiar with the way things are done in the South. All of which is to say that when Madge showed up on our Presbyterian rolls as a new member, she found a comrade in arms. Somewhere along the line, Pastor Rucker had fallen for what was once called the social gospel, although more and more it was simply and incorrectly called Christianity. In other words, his mission seemed less as a teacher and caretaker of the flock, what being a Christian minister once meant, and more as a social worker and protester of civil wrongs, with the likes of him now called missions or outreach or some other euphemism. Lord, I didn't know what we were going to do with that man. Sam and I had been in church every Sunday morning since Pastor Rucker had occupied the pulpit, and all I'd heard was some bleeding-heart sermon about what we weren't doing to lift mankind out of the morass that we'd helped make. And I don't mean that he was speaking of evangelizing the unsaved, nor was he speaking about the great dogmas of our faith, such as atonement, redemption, and such like. No. He was speaking of the need to go on to the highways and byways to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, and register them to vote. In other words, Pastor Rucker was more interested in the needs of the body politic than the needs of the immortal soul. So when he and Madge Taylor met, it was as if they'd each found their counterpart. I am not implying that there was anything sordid going on between them, not at all, given the fact that Pastor Rucker was in his early 30s and Madge was pushing 60 if she was a day. Of course, stranger things have happened, but not in this case. The first idea the two of them came up with was to convert the small daycare center that the church had opened some years ago into an elementary school for the underprivileged. Pastor Rucker had turned the pulpit over to Madge one Sunday to allow her to present their idea to the congregation. Their plan had been to expand the center from toddler care to children in the first three grades. It was the most impractical plan I'd ever heard. Neither had taken into account the need for accreditation, not only of the school, but also of the teachers they'd have to hire. And who would pay them, I'd like to know, as well as pay for age-appropriate desks, tables, and chairs, to say nothing of blackboards, small toilets, low water fountains, and who knew what else? And they hadn't even considered the fact that their school would take over more than half of our Sunday school classrooms, thereby ousting the very ones who had paid to add that building to the church in the first place. In hindsight, Pastor Rucker had made a strategic mistake by allowing Madge to present the plan to the congregation before feeling out the session. I'll tell you, the telephone lines were humming that afternoon as members of the congregation called the members of the session to register their distaste of the plan. The session voted it down. But I'd known that it wouldn't be the end of the machinations between Pastor Rucker and Madge Taylor. Oh, they were made for each other. So if Madge was heading up this Homes for Teens nonprofit group, Pastor Rucker wouldn't be far behind. Chapter 4 Binky, I said, taking a seat in the chair in front of her desk, having called for an appointment as soon as her law office opened that morning. We need your help. I'd like to do this quietly and legally if we can, but if it can't be done that way, I don't mind at all being called every name in the book, because I want it stopped, and I want it stopped before it goes one step further. And what would that be, Miss Julia? Binky had been a very present help in times of trouble before this, and I trusted her quick mind and willingness to go to bat for me in other situations. So I told her of the plans for a residential group home next door to the Pickenses, and who would be housed in it, and whose idea it had been, and the type of homeless who would be living there. "So," I said, "that house is totally unfit for what they want to do, mainly because it's in a settled residential area and it's next door to Hazel Marie." Having delivered my complaint, I sat back in the chair and awaited her assurance that what I wanted could be done. "By the way," I said before she could comment, "forgive me for being so exercised over this that I haven't asked about little Gracie and Coleman. How are they?" Binky smiled. "They're fine, Miss Julia. In fact, Gracie is now enrolled in the First Presbyterian Daycare Center, so she thinks she's a big girl now." "But," she went on, this time in her professional voice, "as to your problem, I know that the town designated that area a local historic district a few years ago, but I'm not sure where the boundaries lie. But I can tell you now that as long as they don't make any exterior changes to the house, being in a historic district won't stop them. So they can do whatever they want on the inside. The first thing, then, that I'll need to do is look at the zoning in that area. Off the top of my head, that entire west side, all the way to Lee Avenue, it may be zoned R15.
"What's that?"
"Essentially residential, and if that's the case, a limited number of adult care homes are permitted. But you say it will house only 14 to 18-year-olds who under the law are considered children, that is, under legal age? I'm sure that family care homes, which are in-home daycare centers for children of working parents, are permitted in that area, but they're strictly supervised as to number and age of children and how many hours of the day they can operate.
Hazel Marie tells me this group has already applied for a permit from the zoning board. Could that mean we're too late?"
"Probably not," she said. "I'll have to see how they've described what they intend to do. Here's the thing, though. I'm positive that residential care facilities are not permitted at all on that property. The problem is, however, that the zoning ordinance isn't exactly clear on the definition of residential care facility."
"Oh, my," I said, sighing. "I should think that those ordinances would be quite specific, seeing that the area is within the town limits."
"Uh-uh," Binky said, shaking her head. "Not necessarily. When those laws were passed, the town fathers wanted to make sure that the commercial district had plenty of room to expand. In fact, that whole area may be zoned C4, which is neighborhood commercial. How far from Main Street is Hazel Marie's block?"
"Well, her house is 4 blocks from mine to the southwest, and mine is 2 blocks west of Main Street, so I'd say that hers is about 6 blocks away from Main, in a ziggy-zaggy sort of way."
"Okay, I'll double-check that. But if it's zoned either C4 or RCT, residential commercial transitional, we may have a battle on our hands. Now, you implied that the church may be supporting this group?"
"Not the church, as far as I know, but I'd bet money on the pastor. He and Madge Taylor, who most definitely is the spearhead,
are as thick as thieves, so I expect he'll present it to the session any day now if he hadn't already." "So there's been nothing in the bulletin. Binky and Coleman were members of the church, but they rarely showed up for the services."
"Not a thing," I answered, "which goes to show that the pastor has learned his lesson. He'll try to get the session's backing before telling the congregation. Just another instance of the underhanded way they're going about this. He'll want to present a fait accompli so that the project will be too far along to stop by the time everybody finds out about it."
"Well, here's something you can do, or Hazel Marie can. Make a list of all who live in the area, using the Cochran House as the center. Get the owners' names of all the houses within a circle of, say, about 4 or 5 blocks in diameter. It's unlikely that there are any homeowners' contracts, as would be the case in a planned community, which would regulate what goes on there, but we'll need to check that, too.
I know a few who live nearby already, I said, perking up at the thought of additional help in sending Madge Taylor elsewhere. Thurlow Jones's house would almost certainly be within 5 blocks of the Cochran house. And Dr. Monroe's, too. You know him, don't you? He's that foot doctor, podiatrist, I think he's called. Binky said, tapping a pencil on her desk. Not good. Doesn't he have an office in his house? That could mean it's zoned MIC, Medical Institutional Cultural, sort of a mixed-use designation, unless he was grandfathered in. My spirits dropped at that. Could that non-profit group claim that they have come under a medical designation, too? It depends on how they've described themselves to qualify as a non-profit. Don't worry, I'll be looking into that. Well, but listen, Binky, I've heard that Dr. Monroe is all but retired. Maybe we can talk him into full retirement and urge him to convert his office back into a living room or whatever it was meant to be. Binky smiled. Every little thing could help. The first thing is to find out who's bought the Cochran house. I'll get started on that and let you know what I find out. In the meantime, get Hazel Marie busy making that list, and you might contact some church members to see how they feel. She paused, pushed back a few curls that had fallen over her forehead, and said, "Did I understand you to say that the session will support this nonprofit?" "No, I don't know it for sure. I only know that Pastor Rucker supported Madge's last wild idea, and he was mightily disappointed when it didn't pan out. But they made a mistake by not going to the session first, so they won't make it a second time." Binky, I tell you that the two of them are do-gooders of the first order. They're so intent on doing good to some that they can't see what they're doing harm to others. This was harder than I thought, I said to Hazel Marie. We were talking on the phone that afternoon after dividing up the surrounding blocks between us. I had been on the telephone all morning and most of the afternoon. "For one thing," I continued, "a lot of people have given up their landline phones and use only cell phones now, and cell phones aren't listed in the phone book."
"I know," she said, "and my phone book must be 5 years old. They don't seem to hand them out like they used to. We may have to go out and knock on doors."
"I'd like to avoid that if we can. But how many people were you able to contact?"
"9, and none of them want a group home in our midst. In fact, Helen Stroud was outraged at the idea. You know how hard she's worked on that house of Thurlow's, and she told me that she's already begun thinking about urging the neighbors to join in a neighborhood beautification effort. And, Miss Julia, you know the teenage boys aren't interested in beautifying anything, except maybe some old cars jacked up in the yard."
Helen Stroud was a divorcee who had made a rapid descent down the social scale when her husband was incarcerated for fraud and embezzlement. After living a year or so hand-to-mouth, she had entered into an agreement to look after Thurlow Jones, the stingiest, most aggravating man alive when he fell off his roof and banged himself up. Helen was being handsomely rewarded for taking care of him when nobody else would.
"I know, Hazel Marie," I said soothingly. "I'm so glad you talked to Helen. She'll be a great help. And the more interest we get from the neighbors, the better. I could almost wish that we lived closer to the Cochran house so I couldn't be accused of meddling in somebody else's business."
"Oh, you don't have to worry about that. Your house is well within the 5 blocks that Binky said would be affected."
I almost missed the chair when I had to sit down.
Chapter 5. Of course it was. I knew that, yet it had simply not registered that a group home full of risky teenagers would impinge on my own property. And Mildred Allen's as well. Her grand house on beautifully landscaped grounds was next door to mine. She most certainly would not welcome anything that lessened the value of her place. To make myself feel better by having a companion in my anxiety, I called Mildred and told her what might soon be located in our midst. "I just wanted to let you know what's going on," I told her.
I have Binky looking to see if we can legally stop them from moving into the neighborhood, and she seems to think that all the neighbors acting in one accord would help.
How much do you need? Mildred asked.
Oh, no, we don't need money, at least not now. I just want to know if you're with us or not.
Absolutely I'm with you. I don't want a gang of little criminals living in the neighborhood. You remember that boy who lived down on Taft Street, the one who broke into every house within walking distance because he was too young to drive? And now they want to put six of the same kind close to us? No, thank you. I can do without that.
Six? I asked. Where did you hear that?
It's in today's paper, but it didn't say where they'd bought a house. I just scanned it because I didn't know it would affect me.
Oh, my. I haven't even looked at the paper today. But if they've gone public, they must be further along than we knew. I've got to hang up, Mildred. I need to see what the paper says.
I usually read the Abbotsville Times soon after it hits the front walk each morning. But this morning I'd been too anxious to be at Binky's office. Then too wrapped up in making phone calls to sit down and read it. The article that Mildred had mentioned was at the bottom of the front page, and reading it made my heart sink.
Nonprofit acquires home for teen boys. Local nonprofit Homes for Teens acquired a house last Tuesday, taking the first public step toward providing a home for homeless teenage boys. The house, located within the city limits, will be remodeled to accommodate up to six homeless teenagers and two full-time house parents. Madge Taylor, president of the Homes for Teens Board of Directors, said, "We are also excited because everything is falling into place much more quickly than we expected. We are so indebted to the marvelous support that we've received from the churches in town, especially to the First Presbyterian Church and the Reverend Robert Rucker, and I must give special mention to a few anonymous donors who have been most supportive of our efforts. We are making every effort to allay the fears of our neighbors who might have been understandably concerned, but who are now rolling out the welcome mat. We will be looking to the community for funds to remodel the house as well as to operate it for the benefit of so many local homeless teenage boys." The article went on to list the members of the board as well as their plans to raise the funds needed to remodel the interior of the house. It also quoted the pastor of a small non-denominational church as saying, "To my mind, it would be absolutely immoral for anyone to be against this effort."
I was sick by the time I'd finished reading it. Madge and her board members had truly made an end run around anyone who would have stood in their way, and now they would be actively raising funds to complete their plans. And, I asked myself, just who were those anonymous donors and who, according to Madge, among the neighbors, had rolled out our welcome mat? The only thing the neighbors I'd talked to would welcome would be seeing the last of her. But what really got to me was that Madge had enlisted clerical support. She'd gone straight to the top, and she'd made sure to mention that our church was supporting them, with special mention of our pastor. Just how were we doing that? No one had told me that we were supporting them. And if they'd actually bought the Cochran house, as the article implied, where did a non-profit get the down payment before they'd even had a fundraiser? Had it come from the church? I was just before taking myself across Polk Street and bearding the pastor in his den when the phone rang. It was Hazel Marie again.
"Miss Julia," she said, "I just have to tell you something I just realized. After reading the article in today's paper, I remembered that I'd seen a real estate agent over at the Cochran House a few weeks ago, and he'd just put an under-contract notice on the for sale sign that was out front. I was in the side yard, so I called to him and asked who was buying the house. See, I was hoping a young family would move in so my girls would have some playmates. But that agent looked me straight in the eye and said he didn't know who was buying it. I think now that he was telling me a story."
"Worse than that, Hazel Marie," I said. "He was outright lying to you. Of course he knew who was buying it, but either he'd been cautioned against telling, or he knew it would cause problems and didn't want to risk losing his commission. That just goes to show that everybody knows that a group home degrades a neighborhood, and everybody who's in on it keeps it under wraps as long as possible. What real estate agency does he work for, anyway?
When she told me, I said, "Well, that's it for me. That agency manages some rental property for me, but no longer. I'm cutting ties with them right away, and I'm telling them exactly why. We'll just see if keeping secrets and lying about it helps their business from now on."
After my usual daily scan of the classified ads to keep abreast of the real estate business in town, I took the newspaper with me and went upstairs to Lloyd's room to use his computer. I am not what one would call electronically proficient, but he'd shown me how to search for things that I was interested in, and that day I was interested in the members of the board of the Homes for Teens. So, working gingerly for fear of messing up Lloyd's computer, I entered each of the names of the 5 board members. I wanted to know just who among the townspeople were supporting Madge Taylor on her mission to usurp our neighborhood. I'd never heard of a single one of them, except Madge, of course, but the other 4, like her, were fairly recent arrivals in our town. Not a one, except Madge, had lived in Abbott's for longer than 5 years, and a couple were so new that they'd probably not yet unpacked all their boxes. From the brief biographies I found, they all appeared well-educated and recently retired, which meant, I suppose, that they were eager to give our little backwater town the benefit of their vast experience and exceptional talents. Coming from large cities, not a one of them would know the pleasures of small-town life, where neighbors knew one another and helped one another, and indeed prayed for one another. They would not think twice about disrupting a quiet, well-established area of homes with a house full of teenage boys, because that would be a good deed, and would merit stars in their crowns as well as local prominence. Then I realized something that absolutely enraged me. Every last one of the board members, including Madge Taylor, lived in one or another of the 2 gated communities on the edge of town. And when I say gated, I mean gated, with a gatekeeper, special stickers on homeowners' cars, and everything else needed to keep out the riffraff. One did not enter those areas without advance notice of one's visit, and each one of those gated communities had a list of rules and regulations that you had to sign and swear you'd uphold before you were allowed to buy into the area. Why, you even had to get approval of the paint color you selected for your own home. And I knew for a fact that at least one of those communities gave their homeowners a choice of 3 exterior colors, and 3 only. So why hadn't those Homes for Teens board members bought a house for homeless teenagers in one of their own communities? Think of the amenities those young boys could enjoy. Swimming pools, tennis courts, golf courses, all designed for good, clean fun that might deter them from continuing a life of crime. Well, of course, I knew why they hadn't. First of all, the homeowners associations would not have permitted such a home in their midst. And second of all, those strict rules that regulated and protected the communities were the very reason that the Homes for Teens board members had bought their own homes there. They wanted to live where nothing was allowed that would detract from the uniformity of the community. But above all, they wanted to live where nothing was allowed that would reduce the value of their homes. So what did they do? They bought a house in a neighborhood far from their own, where it didn't matter to them if it didn't fit into the neighborhood, and where it didn't matter to them if it reduced the value of the surrounding homes. No wonder they were so excited, as Madge Taylor had said, about the purchase on Jackson Street. It fit all their criteria, particularly the one she hadn't mentioned. It was located far from the homes of the board members. I was livid as all these thoughts bounced around in my head. Livid because I also knew, just knew, that not only would we be labeled immoral far and wide, we'd also be accused of selfishness and anti-humanitarianism and, worst of all, of not being Christians.
And all because we, who did not live in gated communities, wanted the same things that those in gated communities already had. Assurance that their investments were safe, and peace of mind from knowing that their neighbors would be screened and vetted. No nasty surprises on the front page of the newspaper for them. Then another thought hit me. Did the fact that homes, as in homes for teens, was plural, mean that they were planning for more than one group home? Was the Cochrane House just the beginning? That's what Hazel Marie and I should emphasize. Watch out. Your neighborhood could be next, and they'll be asking you to finance another such incursion while they sit back, pleased with themselves in their own protected areas. Chapter 6. I wished I had Sam to talk to. His analytical mind and great good sense would keep me on track, especially as I tended to expect the worst outcome of any problem that arose. Not only did I simply miss his company, I missed having his reassurance that I was seeing clearly and choosing the correct course of action. Because to tell the truth, I had some doubts about my stance on that group home, and they almost overwhelmed me that evening. Maybe it occurred to me a true Christian would not only accept what was being done, but also pitch in to help get it done. Maybe I was being purely selfish to worry about the little Pickens twins and the pretty Osborne girl and Lloyd living next door to a house full of potential delinquents. Maybe I should stop worrying about my own and have a little sympathy for those boys who'd not had the privilege of a good upbringing. There was no telling what those boys had seen, experienced, and been exposed to in their young lives, so it was no wonder that they were already halfway off the rails. They probably knew nothing else. As I thought of what some of those experiences might have been, my heart was moved for the abused and misused among us. Every life was worth saving, I firmly believed that. The question was, though, could every life be saved? And in this instance, I meant saved in the sense that Madge and Pastor Rucker meant it. That is, could mistreated, abandoned boys, who had already stepped onto the path of crime, be turned into hard-working, self-supporting, law-abiding citizens simply by moving them into a house on Jackson Street next door to Hazel Marie's children. Just as I was about to concede that maybe they could, I recalled the two things that ran me up the wall about the whole process. The secretive way that Madge and her board had gone about acquiring a house, and the fact that the house was nowhere near hers, or that of any of the other board members. If that didn't tell you something, I don't know what would. And to think that my church, the church that I had supported for lo these many years, was acting in the name of all the members, including me, without telling us one word about it, just ran me up a wall. Lillian, I called as I picked up my pocketbook. I'm going across the street to speak to the pastor. I'll be back before long.
You better put on a sweater or something, she said. Kind of breezy out there today.
I was hot enough to withstand the strongest breeze, so I took off across the street and into the church by the back door that led to the fellowship hall and the group of offices for the staff. When I reached the side hall that led to the office formerly occupied by the Reverend Larry Ledbetter, I was stopped in my tracks. Beside the closed door of the receptionist's office hung a large new sign reading, Office of the Senior Pastor. Senior Pastor. Did that mean we were getting a junior one? And who was going to pay his salary, I'd like to know. Well, of course I knew. We were already well into our annual stewardship drive, and as usual, the bottom line on the new budget was much higher than it had been on last year's. I walked in without knocking, closed the door behind me, and strode up to Norma, who was sitting at her desk. Unhappily, when Pastor Ledbetter retired, she had not. Norma, I need to see the pastor. Do you have an appointment? She asked, her eyes barely flicking up toward me before returning to the paper on her desk. No, I do not, as you well know, since you make the appointments, but I know he's here because his car is parked in his reserved space. This is important. Norma, tell him I'm here."
She blew out a long breath, then very deliberately put down her pencil, got up and walked to the door of the pastor's office, went in and closed it behind her. I was boiling at the rudeness of a paid employee. I knew what was going on behind that closed door. As Pastor